Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is a special coronation edition of the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and at 13 hours GMT on Saturday, the 6th of May, we'll mark an historic day in London, which has been watched around the world.
God save the King!
God save the King!
We will bring you all the key moments of the coronation, reaction from around the world, and discuss the changing attitudes to the British monarchy. Since 1066, kings and queens have been crowned at Westminster Abbey in central London. And today, King Charles' coronation was the 40th of its kind. The service began with a poignant moment when King Charles was greeted by a 14-year-old chorister.
Your Majesty, as children of the Kingdom of God, we welcome you in the name of the King of Kings.
In his name and after his example, I come not to be served but to serve.
While the two-hour-long service contained many traditional elements, this coronation broke new ground. It included female bishops and leaders of other faiths, as well as languages other than English. The opera singer Bryn Terfel sang the first coronation hymn in the Welsh language. Our royal correspondent Helena Wilkinson has been following events for us.
It is pouring with rain, so there were umbrellas up as the King and Queen consort arrived here, followed actually by members of the royal family, the Prince and Princess of Wales, and Prince George as well, who is having a starring role in the coronation service as one of the pages. Inside the Abbey, more than 2,000 guests are inside there, and we've spent this morning witnessing them streaming into the Abbey, taking their seats. From world leaders to politicians to celebrities have all packed out inside the Abbey to witness what will be, of course, an historic occasion, one that we haven't seen since the last coronation of the late Queen 70 years ago.
The British spring weather didn't deter these visitors to the UK, who are among those who camped overnight in central London for a prime spot to view the King and Queen's ride in the Golden State coach along the procession route.
I live in Honolulu, Hawaii, and I came because I find the British royal family fascinating, and I just wanted to witness history and just be a part of all of the excitement.
We're from Miami. We don't have this type of history in America. So being part of this and witnessing it, it's really a nice experience.
22 hours flight from Melbourne, Australia. It's an amazing historical event and we need some beauty in our lives.
Police in London staged a huge security operation for the event. Most of the anti-monarchy protesters on Saturday had congregated in Trafalgar Square, next to the statue of King Charles I, who was beheaded in 1649, leading to a short-lived republic. Elsewhere in central London, an anti-monarchy group said six of their members had been arrested as they were collecting placards for a peaceful protest. Our correspondent Daniel Sanford has more details.
It seems as if they've been arrested under these new anti-protest laws on suspicion of having equipment that would have allowed them to lock on to street furniture and things like that. So there was a concern that they might be preparing to lock on. The people that we spoke to who were being held in handcuffs ahead of being taken away to the police station insisted they didn't have any equipment for locking on. What seemed to be being suspicious was the straps which were holding their placards together.
That was Daniel Sanford. Now,
I'm William the Conqueror, my enemy stood no chance. They call me the first English king, although I come from France. 1066, the doomsday book I gave.
A useful reminder there from the children's book and television series Horrible Histories. King Charles joins a long list of British monarchs. The last time there was a coronation here in London in 1953, a fair proportion of Britons believed that the Queen had been chosen by God. Things have changed, and so has the monarchy, is our royal correspondent, Johnny Diamond.
Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mother, was met at the royal doorway by the Earl Marshal, the Duke of Norfolk.
The good old days. Rationing, one television channel, everything shut on Sundays, Winston Churchill as Prime Minister, and a 27-year-old Elizabeth is crowned.
The moment of the Queen's crowning is come.
50 years on, and things sound very different. Grand monarchy is based on continuity. So how does it adapt to a country that's undergoing wrenching social, political and economic change? One word, slowly.
She's there for the last time, the debutante, the darling of society, waiting to be presented at Buckingham Palace.
Royal endorsement of some of the more ludicrous aspects of the British class system did come to an end. No longer would posh girls be presented at court to the Queen before heading off to hunt a husband. But more serious change would come.
This afternoon, the Queen did me the great honour to ask me to form a government, brought about as it is by the retirement of my old and very dear friend, Anthony Eden.
Before 1965, Conservative Party leaders weren't elected, they just emerged. Professor Craig Prescott from the University of Bangor.
This really came into focus in 63 when Harold Macmillan decided to step down at relatively short notice. And there was no clear leader that the Queen could call upon. And the historians, I think, argue to this day as to whether the Queen acted correctly or not, or whether she was allowed to be perhaps managed by Macmillan to ensure that Rab Butler wouldn't succeed him.
With elected leaders, that power has gone. And the rule is now that Westminster works out who will make the journey to the palace. One of the great royal powers has disappeared.
Also at the palace, the Queen holds the first garden party of her reign.
A changing Britain meant a changing guest list. The garden parties at the palace brought a different kind of person into contact, however fleetingly, with the monarch. And there'd be another point of contact too. What now seems pretty normal, the walkabout, was once extraordinary. Alongside presentational change, some centuries-old rules would eventually be junked. Professor Anna Whitelock from City University London.
If we're talking about the institution of the monarchy, substantively, rather than its style, it was the Succession to the Crown Act in 2013, which meant that no longer was it eldest sons, male primogeniture, that dictated the succession to the throne, but instead it was absolute primogeniture, so boy or girl, the eldest child would inherit the throne.
Change did not come easily to a woman and an institution rooted in tradition, but we all change, even the longest-serving monarch in history. Anna Whitelock again.
The Queen herself changed significantly from a 20-something to a woman in her 90s who became incredibly and increasingly adept at, I think, using the media, not using it too much. Of course, she infamously never gave interviews. But, you know, those final acts of tea with Paddington Bear, I mean, just a really smart way of engaging.
Happy Jubilee, ma'am. And thank you for everything.
That's very kind.
The child of the broadcast age came to understand the power of the medium, a power to project change when beneath the surface much remains the same.
That was Johnny Diamond. One of the characteristics of King Charles' life before becoming king has been his work with young people around the world, notably through his charity, the Prince's Trust. The organisation is all about giving young people opportunities to make the most of their skills. Tracy Ann Harriage from Jamaica was helped by the Trust and is now helping others through her own charitable organisations. And she told Rob Young her story.
I am a survivor of gender-based violence, and I was in a long-lasting toxic relationship for 10 years that almost claimed my life. Now, when I got out of the relationship, I started yearning for empowerment to motivate myself after that whole ordeal. Now, I am a youth leader and I saw a flyer that Prince's Trust has been doing business training for youths. And I initially, when I saw it, I thought it was a scam because it sounded too good to be true. And I decided to do some background checks. When I did so, I realized that it was credible information. And I got a call from the trainer the following day stating that I was successful. And that's basically how I became a part of the Prince's Trust.
Right. So initially you said you thought it was a scam. So you hadn't heard of it before?
No, I didn't.
And so when you say you were successful, what did they do for you?
Okay, so basically it was entrepreneurship training. So what we did was to basically go through all the necessary tools and resources in order for a person to become a successful entrepreneur. So I was able to register my organization afterwards. I was able to do a strategic plan. I was able to write successful proposals in order to get funding for my organizations. And I was able to get a mentorship for a month through the Prince's Trust organization.
And so how are the organizations doing now?
They are doing great. I see youths. We have basically secured almost $500,000 worth of funding thus far in basically doing entrepreneurship trainings for youth who are basically unattached or at risk. And it's a holistic development. The Get Out Alive world, we're basically doing the same empowerment of survivors of gender-based violence. And so while it is that we are definitely doing great, we are definitely in need of more assistance in, you know, continuing our work that we are doing and spanning right across the world. Because it's not just about doing it in Jamaica, because gender-based violence and persons who are affected, it's right across the globe. So we're just starting here and we're branching out worldwide.
Before you came across the Prince's Trust, do you remember what your view was of Prince Charles as he was then, now King Charles? I just wonder whether your interaction with the Trust has perhaps changed your view in any way.
Well, while I am passionate and sentimental about this topic, I will basically reserve my comments about it. But what I do know is that I support and appreciate all the work that he has definitely been doing for the youths who are being influenced by his organizations.
Tracy Ann Harriott speaking to Rob Young. King Charles not only succeeded his mother as the British monarch, but also as the symbolic head of the Commonwealth of Nations, a voluntary network of 56 independent and equal countries, most of them former British colonies. He's also head of state in some of them, although debates continue in several countries about cutting that particular tie. We're going to hear now from a few of them, starting with Jamaica. Nick Davis is in Kingston and spoke to Wendy Urquhart about how Jamaica perceives the monarchy and the coronation.
It's complicated. As you go around Kingston, where I live, there's nothing. When you speak to people about it, many of them they were like, isn't he king already? What's today going to change? But many of them are aware, especially here in Jamaica, that there are things which come as being part of the constitutional monarchy, which lots of them actually still like. One of them is the Privy Council. Here in Jamaica, it's the highest court of appeal. Many people don't have a good relationship with the structures of government. Many of them are still concerned about corruption at every level. And so because of that, it's kind of like the monarchy is a bit of a crutch. These countries may be independent, but there's always a fallback position, which is they were part of the realms of the United Kingdom. And as such, you know, Charles, King Charles is ahead of that. But at the same time, they have no day-to-day relationship with that same country, with the mother country, like what my parents used to call it, because they still need visas to go on holiday to the mother country. They still, when they arrive at Gatwick or Heathrow, they still feel as, you know, as dogs, which are there sniffing you out when you get off the plane. It's not a comfortable relationship between, you know, these countries and the United Kingdom.
William and Kate's trip to Jamaica didn't go down a storm last year, and there are rumblings of Jamaica apparently considering getting rid of the royal family as head of state. What have you heard on that front?
we have to have a referendum here. It's not as easy as it was for Barbados, which could just make the decision, decide amongst parliamentarians and make it happen. Here in Jamaica, we have to have this referendum. We've got to take it to the people. We're starting now to have meetings where people are discussing these issues, looking at changing the constitution. There's many elements of the constitution which do need updating, to say the least. The coronation of King Charles is almost like pressing the accelerator towards making the change. And we're seeing it not only in Jamaica, but St. Kitts and Nevis and many other places around the region who've spoken about it are now thinking about how they can make this happen.
That was Nick Davis in Jamaica. Now let's hear how Australia, another Commonwealth country, has been marking the King's coronation. Phil Mercer is our reporter in Sydney.
We've been at a couple of events over the course of the day. We were at a garden party at Government House here in Sydney. About 200 guests attended a coronation celebration. It started off with a traditional Indigenous smoking ceremony to ward off evil spirits. There was an allegiance to the new king, of course. Charles III is Australia's king. But I think it's safe to say that Australians have a very subdued approach to the coronation. This is a very low-key affair around the country. To many Australians, this has simply been another day. But for those Australians who are supporters of the constitutional monarchy, who have a fondness for the British royal family, this is a momentous day, and they've been celebrating it in their own special way.
What Charles represents is a very stable situation. You look at the state, you look at presidencies. We have two levels whereby if someone makes some sort of error, perhaps in judgment, there is always that other person, that other figure that can correct it or whatever. Now, I don't think any Australians have ever seen the British monarchy interfere with the way we do business in a government sense, but it's nice to have that form of, if you like, someone looking over the shoulder.
The Labour government in Australia, though, Phil, has promised a referendum on the monarchy in the next few years. How divided is Australia on the matter?
It's worth referring to that short clip we heard there of a woman called Joy Dodds. She was attending the garden party at Government House in Sydney, and she was referring to the fact that Australia's constitutional monarchy has brought stability and security to this country. But back in 1975, the Queen's representative here in this country, the Governor General, did sack a government during a period of political instability. It was the first and only time an Australian government had been sacked by the monarch's representative here. So it is incorrect to say that the Governor General hasn't intervened. It is very, very rare. But I think it's safe to say, too, that the coronation of Charles III is again reigniting debate about Australia's constitutional future. Republicans in this country believe that the system is antiquated. Why should Australia have a foreign-born head of state who lives on the other side of the world? The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, is a Republican. He has promised another referendum on a republic, but he hasn't said when. So up until the point that we know when the referendum will occur, the debate about Australia's constitutional future will continue.
That was Phil Mercer. In Canada, some people got up early to watch Charles III officially recognised as their head of state. Our reporter in Canada, Jessica Murphy, joins us now from Toronto. And Jessica, Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau was one of many Canadians participating.
That's right. Trudeau, of course, along with his wife, Sophie Gregoire, Canada's Governor General, Mary Simon, who is the King's representative in Canada. And it was quite a large delegation. There were Indigenous leaders as well, representing First Nations, Inuit, Métis groups, and even a couple of astronauts, including Jeremy Hansen. He was named recently to the coming Artemis II mission, so he'll be eventually the first Canadian to orbit the moon. And just lastly as well, of course, military Royal Canadian Mounted Police will be represented in that coronation military parade.
Now, ahead of the coronation, the King's sister, Princess Anne, the Princess Royal, has been speaking to a Canadian broadcaster, hasn't she? What did she say?
It was an interesting, quite a wide-ranging interview. It touched on many things, from the Queen's death to the coronation and, of course, the future of the monarchy. And at one point, the CBC correspondent, Adrian Arsenault, she asked the Princess Royal whether the royal family discusses with one another the relevance of the monarchy. Take a listen to what she said.
There will be everywhere. It's not a conversation that I would necessarily have. I think it's perfectly true that it is a moment where you need to have that discussion. But I would just underline that the monarchy provides, with the Constitution, a degree of long-term stability that is actually quite hard to come by any other way.
Now, I think one of the questions, of course, as you heard there, was that the royal family has faced about the future of the monarchy, especially when you see opinion polls in places like Canada indicating a falling popularity in a number of countries. Countries like Barbados, for example, recently cutting ties with the monarchy. And I thought Princess Anne's response there was quite interesting, speaking about that long-term stability. And she also spoke as well about how the monarchy in and of itself is really about a sense of broadly of continuity.
So how would you sum up royal feeling in Canada?
I have covered the monarchy in Canada as a subject and on a couple of royal tours a few times over the years. And of course, I have met people with strong opinions on either side, royal fans who really deeply love and respect the institution, and people who don't believe that the monarchy has a place in modern Canada. But I would say that the prevailing opinion, and this is one I've seen and one I think that's borne out in a number of polls I've read over the years, is really a general sense of indifference towards the monarchy. I think Canadians don't necessarily think a lot about the royal family. It does have an important constitutional role in Canada. The king is our head of state, but it is largely symbolic and I think somewhat distant as an institution.
Jessica, thank you. That was Jessica Murphy in Toronto. 2.5 billion people around the world, that's about a third of the world's population, live in a Commonwealth country. And while the roots go back to the British Empire, some countries have decided to sign up to the group in recent years with no historic links. For others, it's yet more complicated. Zimbabwe, for instance, withdrew in 2003 following a suspension for a human rights violation, but later began the process to get readmitted. Shingai Nyoka joins us now from Harare in Zimbabwe. And Shingai, about half the Commonwealth countries are on the African continent. So what have you seen in terms of marking the coronation? Is it being marked?
Well, it has been observed, but only to a certain extent. As you mentioned, Africa has the largest number of countries within the Commonwealth, but Zimbabwe, which is not a member, as well as South Africa, which is, have large communities of dual citizens and expatriates. And there have been holding watch parties, live screenings of the recordings. We've heard reports that in Durban, for example, one group had organized trumpets to sound at the moment that King Charles was crowned. So there is some excitement, and the celebrations are expected to continue to tomorrow, with church services as well as barbecues and high tea is planned. The proceedings have been carried out live on various channels here in Zimbabwe as well. The local broadcaster has been carrying it live, and most people have been watching it from the comfort of their homes. But I think it's more out of a sense of curiosity than anything else. There is that degree of detachment. And that's because most of the African population is under the age of 30, and the relevance of the monarchy is greatly diminished compared to what it was 70 years ago at the previous coronation.
That's very interesting, a feeling of curiosity. So how do Zimbabweans feel about King Charles personally and the British royal family?
It's very difficult to say. King Charles has some historical ties with Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe was the last African country to secure its independence from Britain in 1980. And King Charles the then Prince Charles was sent by the Queen to lower the Union Jack. And so there are those historical ties. But Zimbabwe has since left the Commonwealth and has now applied to become a member again. And so there's a huge debate about what the relevance is of rejoining the Commonwealth. The former President, Robert Mugabe, had taken over white-owned farms and essentially wanted to declare independence from Britain, cut those ties. And so the question is, why does Emmerson Mnangagwa want to return? Many people would say that rejoining the Commonwealth would help Zimbabwe to restore some of its international credibility with Western countries. It remains under sanctions with the United States of America, and Britain has only just recently removed some of those sanctions. And so this really is a matter of credibility. And the fact that President Emmerson Mnangagwa was invited to attend the coronation was hugely significant here. It's the first time in 20 years that a head of state from Zimbabwe has set foot in London. And so for him, it's a step in the right direction. But I think a lot of people will be looking to see what direction a King Charles takes the Commonwealth. We have seen since the death of Queen Elizabeth, there were rumblings, especially in countries like South Africa and Kenya, who believe that the royal family hasn't really taken responsibility for the injustices of the past, of the colonial era. And so there have been calls for apologies. And I think King Charles is mindful of that. But I think a lot of people now are just waiting to see what direction he takes the Commonwealth and what relevance it will have for African countries going forward.
More broadly, across the African Commonwealth countries, have feelings towards membership changed? Have they become more ambivalent?
Well, I think what's interesting to note is that the number of African countries that are now members of the Commonwealth have increased compared to what it was, say, 20, 30 years ago. And what we've seen, rather interestingly, is that countries that really didn't have any colonial ties to the UK, for example, Togo, which was a French colony, and Gabon, as well as Mozambique, have all, and Rwanda as well, have all now become members of the Commonwealth. So there is, they do still see some value. But I think this is the leaders rather than the general population who really don't have an opinion when you speak to them. It's the leaders that want to establish these economic ties, these cultural ties with a country that's powerful.
Shingai, thank you. That was Shingai Nyoka in Harare. Now back to London, and music was central to the coronation ceremony. It ranged from traditional pieces to new commissions by composers and included choral, orchestral and gospel music. Alice Hughes is the royal harpist who performed as part of the service, and she told Amol Rajan more about her unique role.
It's not just playing in the background in Buckingham Palace at all hours of the day, like some people assume, but it very much depends on what's on in the royal calendar. So I might be asked to play for some receptions or dinners, and then more intimate performances, and then obviously the more public side of things, such as the coronation this weekend. I think it's really great to showcase so much work by living composers, which is really, really exciting.
And of course, the King was previously the Prince of Wales. And something that people may not necessarily know is that the harp is in fact the national instrument of Wales.
Yeah, of course. So, yeah, the harp is the Welsh national instrument. And, you know, the harp has an intrinsic part of Welsh culture and Welsh music. Sort of, it just goes hand in hand with the harp. And that's a big reason of why I play the harp, is because it's not that weird to sort of have a harp somewhere in the family when you're in Welsh speaking Wales, which sounds ridiculous, I know.
The royal harpist, Alice Hughes. And that's it from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you'd like to comment on this podcast or the topic covered in it, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @GlobalNewsPod. This edition was mixed by Sarah Kimberley. The producer was Iona Hampson. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.